Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. As always, we're starting with the reading of the chapter, followed by the discussion of the chapter. So, let's dive into it. This is Book 2, Chapter 9 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. Pursued by the French army of 100,000 men under the command of Bonaparte, encountering a population that was unfriendly to it, losing confidence in its allies, suffering from shortness of supplies, and compelled to act under conditions of war unlike anything that had ever been foreseen, the Russian army of 35,000 men, commanded by Kutuzov, was hurriedly retreating along the Danube, stopping where overtaken by the enemy and fighting rearguard actions only as far as necessary to enable it to retreat without losing its heavy equipment. There had been actions at Lombach, Amstetten, and Melk, but despite the courage and endurance, acknowledged even by the enemy, with which the Russians fought, the only consequence of these actions was a yet more rapid retreat. Austrian troops that had escaped capture at Ulm and had joined Kutuzov at Brunau now separated from the Russian army, and Kutuzov was left with only his own weak and exhausted forces. The defence of Vienna was no longer to be thought of. Instead of an offensive, the plan of which, carefully prepared in accord with the modern science of strategics, had been handed to Kutuzov when he was in Vienna by the Austrian Hofkriegsgraf, the sole and almost unattainable aim remaining for him was to effect a junction with the forces that were advancing from Russia, without losing his army, as Mack had done at Ulm. On the 28th of October, Kutuzov, with his army, crossed to the left bank of the Danube and took up a position for the first time with the river between himself and the main body of the French. On the 30th, he attacked Mortier's division, which was on the left bank, and broke it up. In this action, for the first time, trophies were taken, banners, cannon, and two enemy generals. For the first time after a fortnight's retreat, the Russian troops had halted and, after a fight, had not only held the field, but had repulsed the French. Though the troops were ill-clad, exhausted, and had lost a third of their number in killed, wounded, sick, and stragglers, though a number of sick and wounded had been abandoned on the other side of the Danube with a letter in which Kutuzov entrusted them to the humanity of the enemy, and though the big hospitals and the houses in the Krems, converted into military hospitals, could no longer accommodate all these sick and wounded, yet the stand made at Krems and the victory over Mortier raised the spirits of the army considerably. Throughout the whole army and at headquarters, most joyful, though erroneous, rumours were rife of the imaginary approach of columns from Russia, of some victory gained by the Austrians, and of the retreat of the frightened Bonaparte. Prince Andrew during the battle had been in attendance on the Austrian General Schmidt, who was killed in the action. His horse had been wounded under him and his own arm slightly grazed by a bullet. As a mark of the Commander-in-Chief's special favour, he was sent with the news of this victory to the Austrian court, now no longer at Vienna, which was threatened by the French, but at Brünn. Despite his apparently delicate build, Prince Andrew could endure physical fatigue far better than many very muscular men, and on the night of the battle, having arrived at Krems, excited but not weary, with dispatches from Doktorov to Kutuzov, he was sent immediately with a special dispatch to Brünn. Doktorov is one of the Russian generals, according to the footnote. To be so sent meant not only a reward, but an important step towards promotion. The night was dark but starry. The road showed black in the snow that had fallen the previous day, the day of the battle. Reviewing his impressions of the recent battle, picturing pleasantly to himself the impression his news of a victory would create, or recalling the send-off given him by the Commander-in-Chief and his fellow officers, Prince Andrew was galloping along in a postchaise, enjoying the feelings of a man who has at length begun to attain a long-desired happiness. As soon as he closed his eyes, his ears seemed filled with the rattle of the wheels and the sensation of victory. Then he began to imagine that the Russians were running away and that he himself was killed, but he quickly roused himself with a feeling of joy, as if learning afresh that this was not so, but that, on the contrary, the French had run away. He again recalled all the details of the victory and his own calm courage during the battle, and feeling reassured, he dozed off. The dark, starry night was followed by a bright, cheerful morning. The snow was thawing in the sunshine, the horses galloped quickly, and on both sides of the road were forests of different kinds, fields, and villages. At one of the post stations, he overtook a convoy of Russian wounded. The Russian officer in charge of the transport lolled back in the front cart, shouting and scolding a soldier with a coarse abuse. In each of the long German carts, six or more pale, dirty, bandaged men were being jolted over the stony road. Some of them were talking, he heard Russian words. Others were eating bread. The more severely wounded looked silently and with languid interest of sick children at the envoy hurrying past them. Prince Andrew told his driver to stop and asked a soldier in what action they had been wounded. "Day before yesterday, on the Danube," answered the soldier. Prince Andrew took out his purse and gave the soldier 3 gold pieces. "That's for them all," he said to the officer who came up. "Get well soon, lads," he continued, turning to the soldiers. "There's plenty to do still." "What news, sir?" asked the officer, evidently anxious to start a conversation. "Good news. Go on," he shouted to the driver, and they galloped on. It was already quite dark when Prince Andrew rattled over the paved streets of Brünn and found himself surrounded by high buildings, the lights of shops, houses and street lamps, fine carriages and all that atmosphere of a large and active town which is always so attractive to a soldier after camp life. Despite his rapid journey and sleepless night, Prince Andrew, when he drove up to the palace, felt even more vigorous and alert than he had done the day before. Only his eyes gleamed feverishly and his thoughts followed one another with extraordinary clearness and rapidity. He again vividly recalled the details of the battle, no longer dim, but definite, and in the concise form in which he imagined himself stating them to the Emperor Francis. He vividly imagined the casual questions that might be put to him and the answers he would give. He expected to be at once presented to the Emperor. At the chief entrance to the palace, however, an official came running out to meet him, and learning that he was a special messenger, led him to another entrance. "To the right, from the corridor, you are Hochgeboren. There you will find the adjutant on duty," said the official. "He will conduct you to the Minister of War." The adjutant on duty, meeting Prince Andrew, asked him to wait and went in to the Minister of War. 5 minutes later he returned and, bowing with particular courtesy, ushered Prince Andrew before him along a corridor to the cabinet where the Minister of War was at work. The adjutant, by his elaborate courtesy, appeared to wish to ward off any attempt at familiarity on the part of the Russian messenger. Prince Andrew's joyous feeling was considerably weakened as he approached the door of the minister's room. He felt offended, and without his noticing it, the feeling of offence immediately turned into one of disdain, which was quite uncalled for. His fertile mind instantly suggested to him a point of view which gave him a right to despise the adjutant and the minister. Away from the smell of powder, they probably think it easy to gain victories, he thought. His eyes narrowed disdainfully. He entered the room of the Minister of War with peculiarly deliberate steps. This feeling of disdain was heightened when he saw the minister seated at a large table, reading some papers and making pencil notes on them. And for the first 2 or 3 minutes, taking no notice of his arrival. A wax candle stood at each side of the minister's bent, bald head with its grey temples. He went on reading to the end, without raising his eyes at the opening of the door and the sound of footsteps. "Take this and deliver it," said he to his adjutant, handing him the papers and still taking no notice of the special messenger. Prince Andrew felt that either the actions of Kutuzov's army interested the Minister of War less than any of the other matters he was concerned with, or he wanted to give the Russian special messenger that impression. "But that is a matter of perfect indifference to me," he thought. The minister drew the remaining papers together, arranged them evenly, and then raised his head. He had an intellectual and distinctive head. But the instant he turned to Prince Andrew, The firm, intelligent expression on his face changed in a way, evidently deliberate and habitual to him. His face took on the stupid, artificial smile, which does not even attempt to hide its artificiality, of a man who is continually receiving many petitioners, one after another. "From General Field Marshal Kutuzov?" he asked. "I hope it's good news. There has been an encounter with Mortier, a victory. It was high time." He took the dispatch, which was addressed to him, and began to read it with mournful expression. "Oh, my God, Schmidt!" he exclaimed in German. "What a calamity, what a calamity!" Having glanced through the dispatch, he laid it on the table and looked at Prince Andrew, evidently considering something. "Ah, what a calamity! You say the affair was decisive, but Mortier is not captured." Again he pondered. "I am very glad you have brought good news, though Schmidt's death is a heavy price to pay for the victory. His Majesty will no doubt wish to see you, but not today. I thank you. You must have a rest. Be at the leave tomorrow, after the parade. However, I will let you know." The stupid smile which had left his face while he was speaking reappeared. "Au revoir. Thank you very much. His Majesty will probably desire to see you," he added, bowing his head. When Prince Andrew left the palace, he felt that all the interest and happiness the victory had afforded him had been now left in the indifferent hands of the Minister of War and the polite adjutant. The whole tenor of his thoughts instantaneously changed. The battle seemed the memory of a remote event long past. All right, there we have it, another chapter. And I'm not sure if you could hear, but there seems to be a crow hopping around on the roof of my building directly above where I'm sitting. There was a tip-tap for the last page or so of this reading. I hope that wasn't too distracting for you. So we got some more Prince Andrei Bolkonsky action in this chapter. The Russian armies are retreating. They're running away from the French. But even as they run away, they need to fight. The rear guard at the back of this retreat, I suppose you'd think of it like that, are having to keep fighting with the French to keep them at bay. So it's not a good situation to be in, especially if you're one who has to do that fighting. You're basically fighting to try to stall the army so that the rest of your troops can get away. But Andrei Bolkonsky has a bit of a win. So I guess these fights at the rear guard are breaking up into different fights. It's not all in one place. And I think what I got from this is they don't really expect to win these fights. It's really just keep them at bay while we retreat. But Prince Andrei has gone ahead and won one of these battles, which has given a big boost to his morale and the morale of his troops. On Kutuzov's, he heads off to Brunn to deliver the good news about this win that they've had. But the good news isn't really that well received. The Minister of War is more sort of mournful of the losses than he is happy about this win they've had. And it kind of was like the world came crashing down for Andrei a little bit, and he kind of deflated. He'd been all boosted up about this win, and then the reality came back to him, rushing back, that they're still at war and people are still dying and many people have died, and it's really not that good when you look at it as a whole picture. It got me thinking about Andrei and my prediction from a few chapters back. You know, the thing I said about no matter where you go, there you are. He seemed to become a bit disillusioned, a bit crestfallen towards the end of this chapter. And it just reminded me of the crestfallenness of his character in general before he went to war. And, you know, I made a prediction, so obviously I'm looking to try to prove myself right. But it did strike me as his attitude seemed to fall back down to that of his pre-war attitude. And the bit that really made me think that was the way he became very bitter towards the Minister for War and his adjutant, and sort of in his mind decided that they were terrible people. It really reminded me a bit of his attitude towards his wife. But hey, I might be clutching at straws there. I really liked his interaction with the wounded men that he saw. He stopped and he gave them money, and he gave them some really nice words of encouragement, and I quite liked how he said, "Hurry up and get back out there." Which, it might sound like a harsh thing to say to a fallen soldier, but I actually think it's quite comforting to say that to a fallen soldier. You know, it's almost like that It's not that bad. You'll be back on your feet any time now. Hurry up. Up your hop. When, you know, they've got their leg blown off or something like that. You kind of downplay the seriousness of their injuries. Like, you'll be back on the field in no time. And it's also got this air of, it kind of forgives them for having being injured. You know, he's almost saying, I still consider you a soldier. You haven't failed us. You've been wounded. He's almost thankful and not congratulatory, but he's certainly not trying to disparage them for having been injured on the field. I thought it was quite a nice interaction. Regarding this disillusionment that he seems to feel at the end of the chapter, Reddit user Danny Az said, he realized he's just one piece of the big puzzle that is war, and that his emotions, excitement, and perception of the victory are meaningless to the Minister of War. The text reads, he felt as though all the interest and happiness afforded him by the victory had now left him and been given over into the indifferent hands of the Minister of War and the courteous adjutant. This phrase might mean that he chooses to let go of his own excitement and feelings because the Minister of War doesn't really care and he accepts it. Reddit user Grilled Cheese Please said, Andrew doesn't seem to have experienced the terror in battle that Nicholas did in the last chapter, or he hasn't admitted it yet. He's still focused on the glory of their victory and his own bravery and calm in the fighting. Their army, a bit of an underdog at that moment, finally pulled one out. He probably even sees his own wound, a light graze of one arm, as an honourable battle scar. That's all amplified when he receives the honour of delivering the message of their success. So as he reviews the battle in his head, Andrew still views it through the romantic lens that a lot of young men apply to war. He dreams of telling his grand tale to the Emperor himself. So, when he's sent instead to a small minister's office and is told that in the grand scheme of things this battle was barely even a net positive, that there's so much more to accomplish, of course he's deflated. He doesn't even get to tell his story, the minister simply reads the dispatch. Remember how young Andrew is and how he's viewed the glory of a military career as a manly escape from his baffling wife, and how proud of himself he was 10 minutes ago. Of course, he becomes disdainful. It'll be interesting to see everyone's reactions to tomorrow's parade. A little bit of a hint there from Grilled Cheese Please about what's to come in tomorrow's chapter. Sonic Vroom chimed in on this saying, Prince Andre also has reason to be low in spirits, having witnessed the death of so many soldiers and his general, and being charged with travelling to Vienna. When the adrenaline wears off in Vienna, the negative reactions of the Minister of War don't help. I think Prince Andre despises that this bureaucrat, so removed from the fray yet controlling everyone's whereabouts, can safely put everyone in peril. Andre might also distrust the minister for all the previous losses. There was another question by Reddit user Garrock who said, the text refers to the laws of the new science of strategy. What is meant by this? Had the way wars were planned changed significantly in that time period? Reddit user Alfimon answered this by saying, I am no expert in military strategy, but as a fan of Europa Universalis 4 and other Paradox video games, I don't know what those are by the way, I know their engine is called Clausewitz in honor of a Prussian scholar whose book, On War, is considered one of the pillars of modern military strategy. Searching for more information, I found the military strategy entry in Wikipedia, Military Strategy, Napoleonic. It's full of interesting facts. Basically, Napoleon was a military genius who broke every convention of how war was fought. One fragment that summarizes it well is this. Napoleon's practical strategic triumphs, repeatedly leading smaller forces to defeat larger ones, inspired a whole new field of study into military strategy. In particular, his opponents were keen to develop a body of knowledge in this area to allow them to counteract a masterful individual with a highly competent group of officers, a general staff. The two most significant students of his work were Karl von Clausewitz, a Prussian with a background in philosophy, and Antoine Henri Jomini, who had been one of Napoleon's staff officers. I suppose that, you know, the scientific mind was fairly new at that time, and they were turning it to the field of war strategy. That looks like a Wikipedia rabbit hole that I could really get lost in, but I'm not going to click on that military strategy Napoleonic link, not at the moment at least. I might look it up at a later date. I think that just about covers this chapter, but I will tell you something that happened today that I found amusing. So I was using the brand spanking new A Year of War and Peace Instagram account, which I created for the podcast, and I noticed there's a hashtag A Year of War and Peace. So I clicked it, and that linked me in with, I guess, some of the listeners of this podcast. And the very first post that I saw, and I had a look and I read the description, mentioned and shouted out this podcast, which I just found so cool. So I pressed follow, and I pressed like. And then within a few minutes, I was having a conversation with this Instagram user on the direct message function. We were talking about how cool the community is, how much we're learning. You know, we were just kind of talking about the experience. And then they said to me that this kind of tripped me out a little bit. They said that they listen to the podcast every day when they're working out, when they're on the treadmill, they said. Which the reason that tripped me out is because every day I try to every day, but let's say every second day maybe, I go to the gym and I use the elliptical machine, the treadmill machine thing there, and I listen to a podcast, and then I head to work, and then I record my own podcast and put it out there. And just to think that someone else is doing that routine as well, but listening to me, it's a real, I don't know, it's just so strange. It really spins you out. So it was really cool to connect with someone over Instagram. And then I gave them a little tour of the office, and I showed them the space where I record the podcast and everything like that. It was quite fun. So I want to say a big thank you to that listener for giving me that shout out on Instagram. It really does make a big difference. You know, I'm watching the statistics of the podcast, and you know what I expected to see was a downward trend. You know, the first episode after the first day had about 110 listens or something like that, and I thought, oh cool, everyone's checking it out, but not everyone will stick around, and then that'll peter out, sort of thing. But it's gone the other way, and by now I'm getting about 150 listens per day, so it's slowly climbing, and I just love that. I love that that people are connecting with it. It gives me a real thrill. So thank you to those people who are sharing the podcast and letting other people discover it. I am going to sign off on that note. Thanks again very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.